welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. I am G.R. Mobley. This is an educational grassroots program focused on uniting and leading in restoring the Republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again. And welcome back. And it is now or never. And that debt is fraud. And what we're going to do today, folks, is change up a little bit. And I mean this sincerely. As I went through and I scrubbed the remaining Federalist Papers, this is kind of where Hamilton just maintains an ambiguity regarding the court actions, the jurisdiction, you know, trial by jury, as he's been doing this past couple of Federalist Papers. So as we have, so as we have looked at the initial assertions by Hamilton, we can find that in Federalist Paper number 80 is really, so here's the sophistry. He put out a total of 8 Federalist Papers that nobody really read. At least they didn't read it at the time he printed it or wrote it and supposedly handed it over to, you know, his faithful friend that supposedly printed it, because there was no point in printing it. It would have tipped his hands. I mean, who wouldn't have said, hey, why are you continually printing these things out here when the debate's going on in the convention right now? Why was he doing both? So what we're going to do, because I've already scrubbed the ratification base because they did this a long time ago. And so what we're going to do is I want to show you, because I mentioned that I know he claimed the court had a requirement of creating a uniformity of the laws for the union. And in other words, empowering them to eventually dictate to the states how they have to, you know, provide justice for these very specific laws. In other words, it's a slow takeover as this metamorphosis of the court system under John Marshall, the protege of Alexander Hamilton. Now, I could just be saying that, right? Take GR's word for it, that he's a protege. Actually, Russell Kirk wrote a book from Edmund Burke to Eliot or something like that, The Conservative Mind. It's a book about the philosophies of the framers and, you know, these great minds of the time. And if you read that book, actually Russell Kirk's the one that spells it out. He said it long before I did, that John Marshall was a protege. I mean, he looked up to Alexander Hamilton as this, you know, brilliant ball of energy. And it's interestingly enough that when you look at Hamilton, Hamilton and Hamilton's life, and how, because we'll get to it eventually, when we get into the congressional records, Hamilton himself was probably the least honorable man that I can think of that we read up on because of all of the underhanded things he was doing. And these things came to light. It came to light that he was having a, you know, torrid affair. And and the husband of the wife was, you know, I'll just say blackmailing him so that he could, you know, make money off of this. And anyway, if you read the details on this, I got to a point where I can't believe that Hamilton even let it persist. I mean, he should have just gotten right, but he didn't. He continued his torrid affair while he was paying this husband, paying the husband of his mistress while the husband was in the house. I mean, it was just like, what the heck? You wouldn't think that that would have just been acceptable back in those days. But nevertheless, that was just one of the things that Hamilton, you know, fell on, or one of the swords he fell on. He fell on the, you know, I'll say the biggest sword he fell on was the seeking of power. Interestingly enough, he didn't seek power to become president of the United States. He sought power by corrupting people and getting people to do everything he wanted them to do. In other words, it wasn't important whether he became president of the United States. And I think one of the things that probably kept him from doing that was the downfall, or I should say the exposure, of his Tord affair. But more importantly, when we look at how he went through the public debates from the Continental, not the Continental, from the convention, the Constitutional Convention, the Federalist Papers, and the ratification debates, he literally talked out of both sides of his mouth. And so we're going to be covering, we're just going to go back and kind of read the highlights of where he set his foundation. The important thing is, this is the sophistry, as I was trying to expose. If you know where to look, then all you need to do is cite the ironclad argument that he provides that makes it so that who can challenge what he just said? Yeah, you can go back and read these other papers where he talks mildly bold, where he points to the courts as the guardians of the Constitution, which sounds good, but in reality, he has given them power to actually subvert the Constitution in what he was doing here, especially if his plan played out. And as we look at what ended up playing out, his plan did play out, because the court was, you know, an honorable court, and these were supposedly honorable men. And as they started elevating the Federalist Papers to say, well, the Federalist Papers say, you know, we can do these things. This was the design of our framers. And actually, it wasn't the design of our framers at all. The Federalist Papers were not our framers, you know, coming to an agreement. These were literally editorials by individual men. I can read Madison's assertions and go, wow, this is great. And interestingly enough, I've actually read some people citing these Federalist Papers that Hamilton wrote, and somehow they've been mislabeled that Madison wrote them. No. Anyway, folks, these later papers that he wrote, unless you're actually creating a direct context, but what Hamilton states in these later papers is not definitive. He's just talking and creating contrasts and comparisons, as we've kind of gone through over the past few days. As a matter of fact, welcome back, John.
Good to be here, sir.
And so, as a participant in the past few days, it's like, you know, he keeps on maintaining this ambiguity of jurisdiction. It just seems open. It just seems like what he's covering is interesting, but it's not literally defining, you know, the particular processes based on the powers given. It's like theory almost. When we get into the Federalist Papers, or I mean the ratification debates, we can find, and you'll be able to find him speaking about political theory. What does that have to do with, you know, the power of the judiciary? So what I'd like to do is I want to do a go back. And we need to go back to Federalist Paper number 80. And actually, in 83, I think the term of uniformity came up. Let me see here. In 32, on Federalist Paper number 83, he says, it is, and this is really more towards some uniform plan with respect to the limits of common law. And but see, there never was a plan for that. And so the use of uniform in 83 is inconsequential. It comes up three times. Uniform or uniformity, the word in basic framing of uniform, comes up three times in these papers, 78, 80, and 83. And so in 83, this is where he literally lays it out, and he paves the way for the Supreme Court to start assuming all sorts of powers and to be able to start creating law, redefining law, and so forth. And so let's just read Federalist Paper 80, paragraph 4, 5, and 6.
Okay. Paragraph 4. The first point depends upon this obvious consideration, that there ought always to be a constitutional method of giving efficacy to constitutional provisions. What, for instance, would avail restrictions on the authority of the state legislatures without some constitutional mode of enforcing the observance of them? The states, by the plan of the convention, are prohibited from doing a variety of things, some of which are incompatible with the interests of the Union, and others with the principles of good government. The imposition of duties on imported articles and the emission of paper money are specimens of each kind. No man of sense will believe that such prohibitions would be scrupulously regarded without some effectual power in the government to restrain or correct the infractions of them. This power must either be a direct negative on the state laws or an authority in the federal courts to overrule such as might be in manifest contravention of the Articles of the Union. There is no third course that I can imagine. The latter appears to have been thought by the convention preferable to the former, and I presume will be most agreeable to the states.
As to all right, the second thing, excuse me. So I'm going to interrupt you after each of these. So this is where I stepped into, if you remember, using the militia, because he talks about the two courses of exerting power, that it's either going to be by the federal court or the state court. Like, that is where the power resides. And actually, the power of enforcement, when it's trying to correct infractions, comes from the execution of the law, which is the executive. And actually, that's a very specific power. And we talked about the process that Congress, in the constitutional process, they're supposed to call forth the militia to execute the laws of the Union. So when they call them forth, they federalize them, and they basically give the president, who's the commander-in-chief, however he wants to organize them and go execute that law. That's the process. That is the third, and actually it's the only constitutional process. Courts do not have the authority of enforcement. I mean, Lincoln knew that. That's why he told Taney, I'd like to see you enforce that. Anyway, so forgive me for the interruption, but we'll do the same with 5 and 6. Go ahead with 5. Thank you.
5. As to the second point, it is impossible by any argument or comment to make it clearer than it is in itself. If there are such things as political axioms, the propriety of the judicial power of a government being coexistive with its legislative may be ranked among the number. The mere necessity of uniformity in the interpretation of national laws decides the question. 13 independent courts of final jurisdiction over the same causes arising upon the same laws is a hydra in government from which nothing but contradiction and confusion can proceed.
Right there. This right here, folks, is the paragraph where the federal court basically lassos all of the states and says, this is how we're going to do justice in America. The propriety of the judicial power of a government being coextensive, he's making them equal to the legislation or the legislative body, coextensive with its legislative, may be ranked among the number. The mere necessity of uniformity in the interpretation of the national laws decides this question. And then he says, there's no way we can allow 13 independent courts to have final jurisdiction over the same causes arising upon the same laws, bypassing completely the specific jurisdiction. He's just saying that, hey, they're going to be doing things, and if we assume jurisdiction over it, then we will prevail. Like elections, when the court has no jurisdiction over elections because it doesn't arise under the Constitution, at least in the past election cases that we've seen, that is not their charge. As a matter of fact, when you read the Constitution, Congress has the responsibility of ensuring that the elections and the outcome of the elections is appropriate, proper, and accurate, not the courts. So when we, anyway, go ahead with six. In the interest of time, let's go ahead with six.
Six. Still less need be said in regard to the third point. Controversies between the nation and its members or citizens can only be properly referred to the national tribunals. Any other plan would be contrary to reason, to precedent, and to decorum.
So what we have read here has literally laid it out. So when Marshall or whatever, Joseph Story was the one that really started playing this. Marshall was being nice, not trying to assume powers directly. What Marshall was doing was he was making rulings and innuendos in his opinions how they could break through the Constitution using those four portals: the General Defense and Welfare Clause, the Commerce Clause, the Necessary and Proper Clause, and the Supremacy Clause. Those were the primary portals that they like to use to assuming power. And so this is where, again, Marshall made sure in eight landmark cases that he made sure that he added a misinterpretation of those clauses. If you go to the ratification debates of how those clauses were nailed down in every single state harmoniously, in other words, there wasn't a conflict in any of the ratification debates of how they basically refuted the anti-federalist assertions that there were unconstitutional powers or there was evil powers in those four clauses. And what Marshall did was he started creating evil interpretations and definitions of those four clauses by basically uttering that the Supremacy Clause gives the federal government the ability to become to act supreme in anything it deems necessary and proper, when he started marrying these clauses together. I mean, this was done with, I would like to say that this was really top-notch theater and top-notch, you know, intrigue and conspiracy. But it really wasn't. What was really happening, folks, is there were a lot of really great people that were doing great things in government, and there were a few sinister people that nobody thought that, you know, this was America's best and brightest in the federal government. And nobody really thought that there were men that had machinations and designs to literally undermine and get a direction for the courts, a direction for Congress, and a direction for the executive to operate outside the bounds of the Constitution. Nobody thought that that was happening. Everybody saw it because nobody saw, you know, their rights or, you know, British or foreign, you know, governments speaking different languages, commingling, what have you. Nobody saw the threat. They really believed that they were heading in the right direction. The fact is that the attack started so early, and the fact that this constitutional republic has been able to maintain itself for 250 years, that's what's amazing. Because the Constitution and its intricacies and checks and balances and so forth have made it so hard, even with the way they have broken through these parchment barriers, even though the way they've gone through the Constitution or bypassed it, we still stand today in a position where we can take this republic back. Think about that. You know, if anybody was a calculating person, they would have actually had this all locked down to where there's just no way. And actually, folks, I'm here to tell you there is a way. And it's pretty easy. And it's all about holding your public servants accountable. So anything to add, Sean, of, you know, what you've been reading? I mean, you see how this right here, when somebody lays this down, I mean, what regardless of what you bring forward out of any of the later papers, this refutes it.
Yes, sir. I saw something in number 78 as well.
Uh-huh. Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Where he said that a limited constitutional prescription must have the authority to declare laws void when they are contrary to the manifest tenor of the Constitution.
Oh, sure, well,
that
sure.
That sounds good.
What paragraph was that? What paragraph was that?
I'm not sure. It's in Federalist 78.
Uh-huh.
I'm not referencing that. I found it somewhere else. Not straight from the source.
Okay, okay. That's fine. So I know in Federalist 78, paragraph 12, where, because I've highlighted all of these things, and I'm going to share these mm-hmm. highlights with you, the listeners, in the next few weeks, so you can come back and literally go through these things. But the one line that is in paragraph 12 that is, everybody should understand the evil. This is probably the shining brightest evil in this one Federalist paper. It says, the interpretation of the laws is the proper and peculiar province, the right of the courts. When that wasn't granted. And as a matter of fact, we went through this already, going through these, in a previous show, how I showed you how none of the states trusted their courts. Actually, there were two or three states. The majority of the states did not trust the courts, which is why the judiciary was framed in such a way that its hands were tied behind its back. And yet, Houdini shows up, and next thing you know, Houdini's riding the ship out of port to conquer the world. Anyway, all right, so putting this aside, let's go ahead and open up, because I have this as Appendix E, which are Hamilton's speeches during the ratification debates. And what we have in this document, folks, is a bunch of highlights, because I've already scrubbed this a long time ago, and I may have mentioned this before, but we have a lot of highlights. And so what I want to do is start off with June 17th. And just so you understand, this is the very beginning of the ratification debates. So in other words, Hamilton really needs to show up and kind of keep everybody grounded to say, you really have to prove this document as something that's bad. So he can't get away with being milquetoast in the very first week. But we want to make sure, because understanding the way he laid out definitively the powers of the court, let's see, and as a matter of fact, out of this document, because I have all of the citations, you know how many times he mentions the word court out of all of these orations? And, folks, we're looking at 25,000 words of Hamilton uttering in the ratification speech. 25,000 words. How many of those 25,000-plus words were the word court? Two. And yet he wrote, while this was going on with his other hand, he was writing the Federalist Papers, going into the court, their power and their ability and their greatness, while he was just skimming beyond and past it, obviating literally what he was doing. So when we come back, we're going to go into a break here. But when we come back, what we want to do is dive into this. And as a matter of fact, that the first mention of the court is on June 27th. It's a good 10 days well after. I think they started maybe on the 16th or 15th, maybe the 17th of June. But so it's 10 days later where he just casually mentions the court. And he's already written quite a bit on it. We'll be right back, folks.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review as well as my description of the republic review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how republic review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you.
As a reminder, if you have any questions or comments, we have a 24-hour comment line, 425-270-5416.
Okay, so welcome back. And so, Sean, I mean, on just to share this with you, on the 27th of July, as I look at Hamilton's Federalist Paper, you know, notations, and so where are they right here? By the 27th of July, let me see, he has already written all of these Federalist Papers up to 84. 84 was his very last real commentary on the judiciary. Actually, the title for this was Certain General and Miscellaneous Objections to the Constitution Considered and Answered. The arrogance of this guy. So technically, 84 and 85 were really kind of the general stuff. So the first time he's mentioned the court, he's already written everything in the Federalist Papers, these secret Federalist Papers, everything he wanted to say about the court. So, okay, you can't tell me that, you know, this isn't just some, just a coincidence. It's not a coincidence at all, folks. Anyway, so on the 17th, Hamilton, and they kind of kick this off, Hamilton basically makes his first point, or in his first long oration, one of the first points he talks about is this new system. Now, this is important because Patrick Henry and others pointed out that this is a brand new government, folks. This is not what you're used to. This is not the simplistic, you know, you've got representatives, you go to them, they do everything. What this is it literally is a magistrate government divided into a separate legislative, executive, as well as judiciary. That's one of the reasons why I pointed out the framework of all of the current states were literally just focused on the legislative. There was a relationship in many cases with the executive and the judiciary to that legislative. And the legislative ruled, just like Continental Congress. Continental Congress was a legislative body. It was the magistrate instead of a king. It was a body Congress. And each state, just like the Roman Senate, each state had one vote, or they all had equal, you know, weight. So anyway, Sean, you ready to go, or do you have anything else you want to add to what we covered so far?
No, sir. Where are we going to start then?
We're going to start with the new system on June 17th with the ratification debates, Appendix E. Now, folks, we're reading this out of a different document where I've just isolated everything of Madison. I'm going to be posting the New York ratification debate. So, again, you go by the date, and then you can see these entries, new system, slaves, new states, and blah, blah, blah. So anyway, let's cover what he's going to say about this new system.
Excuse me. What then shall we do? Shall we take the old confederation as the basis of a new system? Can this be the object of the gentleman? Certainly not. Will any man who entertains a wish for the safety of his country trust the sword in the purse with a single assembly organized on principles so defective, so rotten? Though we might give to such a government certain powers with safety, yet to give them the full and unlimited powers of taxation and the national forces would be to establish despotism, the definition of which is a government in which all power is concentrated in a single body. To take the old confederation and fashion it upon these principles would be establishing a power which would destroy the liberties of the people. These considerations show clearly that a government totally different must be instituted. They had weight in the convention who formed a new system. It was seen that the necessary powers were too great to be trusted to a single body. They therefore formed two branches and divided the powers that each might be a check upon the other. This was the result of their wisdom, and I presume that every reasonable man will agree to it. The more the subject is explained, the more clear and convincing it will appear to every member of this body. The fundamental principle of the old confederation is defective. We must totally eradicate and discard this principle before we can expect an efficient government. The gentlemen who have spoken today have taken up the subject of the ancient confederacies, but their view of them has been extremely partial and erroneous. The fact is, the same false and impracticable principle ran through the ancient governments. The first of these governments that we read of was the Amphictyonic Confederacy. The council which managed the affairs of this league possessed powers of a similar complexion to those of our present Congress. The same feeble mode of legislation in the head and the same power of resistance in the members prevailed. When a requisition was made, it rarely met a compliance, and a civil war was the consequence. Those that were attacked called in foreign aid to protect them, and the ambitious Philip, under the mask of an ally to one, invaded the liberties of each and finally subverted the whole.
Okay, so interestingly enough, in this, he actually makes an assertion that shows that it was seen that the necessary powers were too great to be trusted to a single body. They therefore formed two branches and divided the powers that each might be a check upon each other. Now, let me ask you this. What the heck is he talking about there? What two branches? Because clearly, Continental Congress, as I've said before, was a magistrate form of government. It was a single magistrate government. They had all the power within that body. He's saying that there's two branches. What two branches do you think he's shining a light on? And guess what branch he's not shining a light on at all?
Yeah, I would think the legislative and the executive.
There you go, correct.
From his example from history.
Creating the laws and what he's talking about, creating the laws and enforcing them.
Right.
He didn't want to touch that third branch. Maybe he was downplaying it, and he was, you know, what we don't see here, folks, is the side comments that Hamilton was going around not saying under record or on the record. In other words, when these men got up and spoke, these were conventions where they were under oath. They were bearing testimony. Do you think that the same liability of what was printed in the newspaper was being held over his head? No. See, there's a huge difference when you're speaking on the record how you can be held liable, where he was probably having, there's no doubt in my mind, he was having water cooler conversations. He was doing all sorts of things in helping people see this skewed view of his, in obviating and saying, don't worry about that judiciary. I mean, it's really, and there's no power there. Obviously, this right here, I think, just starting off is a good indictment. But let's go ahead. Now he starts talking about slaves, because this is one of the topics that becomes very important, because as we look at the problems that we still carry today as a nation, the paradigm in their day, how adamant were these people for slavery? These people that were framing and accepting the Constitution, and how adamant against it and what have you. And you'll see, as we go through this, that the only states who truly defended slavery were those southern states. You'll find some defense of slavery in Virginia, but the Carolinas and Georgia, boy, that whoop. And actually, Georgia rubber stamped it. Georgia really didn't vigorously debate it. They had to go along with it because they knew that they needed, they were right there. They were the brunt of the first impact if Spain decided to attack, because they were right there. They were the first colony or state facing Spain. So let's go ahead and read this oration on slavery as well.
The first thing objected to is that the clause which allows a representation for three-fifths of the Negroes. Much has been said of the impropriety of representing men who have no will of their own. Whether this be reasoning or declamation, I will not presume to say. It is the unfortunate situation of the southern states to have a great part of their population, as well as property, in blacks. The regulation complained of was one result of the spirit of accommodation which governed by the convention, and without this indulgence, no union could possibly have been formed. But, sir, considering some peculiar advantages which we derive from them, it is entirely just that they should be gratified. The southern states possess certain staples, tobacco, rice, indigo, etc., which must be capital objects in treaties of commerce with foreign nations, and the advantages which they necessarily procure in those treaties will be felt throughout all the states. But the justice of this plan will appear in another view. The best writers on government have held that representation should be compounded of persons and property. This rule has been adopted, as far as it could be, in the Constitution of New York. It will, however, by no means be admitted that the slaves are considered altogether as property. They are men, though degraded to the condition of slavery. They are persons known to the municipal laws of the states which they inhabit, as well as to the laws of nature. But representation and taxation go together, and one uniform rule ought to apply to both. Would it be just to compute these slaves in the assessment of taxes and discard them from the estimate in the apportionment of representatives? Would it be just to impose a singular burden without conferring some adequate advantage?
Okay, so one of the things he didn't point out, though, because we learned it this year, at least I learned it, and welcome to learning along with GR, that the idea of three-fifths rule, the three-fifths rule, came from the Articles of Confederation, or actually came from, I guess, a treaty and or legislation that Continental Congress provided in 1783. Because they just deferred back to that compromise and said, okay, we'll just apply that. And so he could have, and I don't think he could have, because I don't think that Hamilton was at the convention at that time when that came out and why they decided to keep that. The question is, and the thing I do know, is that it wasn't brought up. When we go through this, I do not remember this information being brought up at all during the ratification debates. In other words, it's not about sidestepping, but it's important to point to the source of, you know, this, because it was already accepted by the Confederation and the states at that time. And we're not even talking about a decade later. We're talking, you know, 7-8 years later. So, okay, why can't we just apply that same rule? And that became the no-nonsense way to move forward, was they were just going to apply the same rule. Okay, so now new states and apportionment.
There is one source of increase also which does not depend upon any constructions of the Constitution. It is the creation of new states. Vermont, Kentucky, and Franklin will probably become independent. New members of the Union will also be formed from the unsettled tracts of Western Territory. These must be represented and will all contribute to swell the federal legislature. If the whole number in the United States be, at present, 3 millions, as is commonly supposed, according to ratio of 1 for 30,000, we shall have, on the first census, 100 representatives. In 10 years, 30 more will be added, and in 25 years, the number will be doubled. Then, sir, we should have 200. If the increase goes on in the same proportion, the Convention of Massachusetts, who made the same objections, have fixed upon this number as the point to which they chose to limit the representation. But can we pronounce with certainty that it will not be expedient to go beyond this number? We cannot. Experience alone must determine. This matter may, with more safety, be left to the discretion of the legislature, as it will be the interest of the large and increasing states of Massachusetts, New York, Pennsylvania, etc., to augment the representation. Only Connecticut, Rhode Island, Delaware, and Maryland can be interested in limiting it. We may therefore safely calculate upon a growing representation according to the advance of population and the circumstances of the country.
Okay. And he continues on about this, but the interesting thing is he points out how quickly they're going to be in, you know, just in a few decades, there'd be well over 200 representatives in Congress. That's a lot. But when you look at how many people that they'll be representing, because at this point it'll be less than 100, and it's 3 million. And as they go, you know, probably into 4 or 5 million, they're easily going to maybe 125. The point is that as we look at these new states coming into the Union, they're going to bring in, this is, becomes a huge relief for the existing states. This becomes a huge relief for the federal government to now spread the wealth among new states that are offering new things. They may be offering, you know, more agricultural, you know, meat and what have you. Furs, as a matter of fact, furs became very common as a common export and a common consumable, because there was an excess of wildlife out there in the wild, wild west. And as they started harnessing all of this, it really became an incentive for the federal government to bring states in quickly. This is why you hear me complain constantly how Congress violated the Constitution, because they were bringing states in before they could be self-sufficient. They didn't have a militia. They could not protect themselves. Lots of little things, lots of little problems, and the federal government was already doing things, taking away sovereignty of many of the new states. As a matter of fact, they went back in 1820 to some of the earlier states, Florida and so forth, and said, look, you're going to have to do this, this, and this, and you're going to give us property so that we can sell it. And they leveraged all of that on most all of the new states. So anyway, I think they went all the way back to Ohio. But when we get to that Land Act of selling public land, where they created this idea that they possess public land, unconstitutionally, of course. But anyway, let's go to the next one. On June 21st, Hamilton starts talking about checks and balances.
From the competition that ever subsists between the branches of government, the president will be induced to protect their rights whenever they are invaded by either branch. On whatever side we view this subject, we discover various and powerful checks to the encroachments of Congress. The true and permanent interests of the members are opposed to corruption. Their number is vastly too large for easy combination. The rivalship between the houses will forever prove an insuperable obstacle. The people have an obvious and powerful protection in their state governments. Should anything dangerous be attempted, these bodies of perpetual observation will be capable of forming and conducting plans of regular opposition. Can we suppose the people's love of liberty will not, under the incitement of their legislative leaders, be roused into resistance and the madness of tyranny be extinguished at a blow? Sir, the danger is too distant. It is beyond all rational calculations.
And again, this is Hamilton. Is that not dismissive?
Absolutely.
I don't think he really covered how, you know, the liberties of the people were going to be safe.
And it's amazing how at the time you hear quotes from all these other people saying just the opposite. Saying we have to guard against this happening. We have to make sure that this doesn't happen.
Right.
And he's like, oh, it's never going to happen.
Right, 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 right. Yeah, and so, again, Hamilton knowing that he's under oath, that these words, you know, can come back to haunt him. So he's very careful, like a lawyer, in making sure what he says can't come back to, you know, ruin what he's trying to do. Okay? So here he talks about a phantom. He likes using this word, a phantom. And I think this was well before Phantom of the Opera, of course. Anyway, let's go ahead.
Sir, we hear constantly a great deal which is rather calculated to awake our passions and create prejudices than to conduct us to the truth and teach us our real interests. I do not suppose this to be the design of the gentleman. Why then are we told so often of an aristocracy? For my part, I hardly know the meaning of this word as it is applied. If all we hear be true, this government is really a very bad one. But who are the aristocracy among us? Where do we find men elevated to a perpetual rank above their fellow citizens and possessing powers entirely independent of them? The arguments of the gentlemen only go to prove that there are men who are rich, men who are poor, some who are wise, and others who are not. That, indeed, every distinguished man is an aristocrat. This reminds me of a description of the aristocrats I have seen in a late publication styled The Federal Farmer. The author reckons in the aristocracy all governors of states, members of Congress, chief magistrates, and all officers of the militia. This description, I presume to say, is ridiculous. The image is a phantom. Does a new government render a rich man more eligible than a poor one? No, it requires no such qualification. It is bottomed on the broad and equal principle of your state constitution.
Okay, so here he's basically attacking this idea of how this government is creating an aristocracy. At the time, they were aristocracies. Every state government was an aristocracy, because if you look at the names of who was in the conventions, who was serving in their state legislature, they all took their turns. And when they weren't there, then they were back at home, you know, ranching or farming or fabricating, whatever. They, you know, they supported themselves and their families based on their, you know, their skills. But they wanted to cut their teeth in politics. They wanted to be able to elevate themselves. And these people that had the education, this was the elite. These were aristocrats. Right, wrong, or indifferent, they were aristocrats. However, he is correct, and Madison kind of points this out as well as others do, that the government and the Constitution was created so that anybody could actually have a fair run. Now, as long as the Constitution doesn't get undermined by the states in any way or by another faction in any way, anybody can get their name on a ballot and run as a senator and become a senator now, because you're not prostituting yourself to the state legislature. You can get elected. Now, just keep in mind that the 17th Amendment only changed the manner of how people would be selected or chosen to go into the Senate. Doesn't mean that the state legislature doesn't have a right to control every vote that goes on in that Senate. So the 17th Amendment is constantly being misclassified as a boogeyman. And the problem is the states are refusing to demand their suffrage, but that be that what it is. The point is this, that not anybody can actually get their name on the ballot, because states, via the party and party laws, have created a barrier so that you can't get your name. You have to go into a primary where they go through and the party basically eliminates you. Well, how is that serving your right to be on the general ballot to basically have an opportunity to be elected amongst all the names in the election? See, the primary is all unconstitutional. The Constitution doesn't allow for a primary. And I know everybody goes, look, when we look at the majority of America, almost 80% of all the seats are foreordained by the party, because those counties and those districts where those people are being elected, they're either red or they're blue. So it's hands down, you're going to be being elected. It's almost hands down that you, the Democrats in the blue election areas, are going to be elected. And the red areas, the Republicans are going to be elected. So why would you submit to a primary? Nobody's going to give the Democrat any consideration. And if you do like what a lot of states do, just do a runoff. You guys do runoffs, right?
Yes, sir.
And so why not? Why not just do a runoff of the top two or top three, whatever, so that it forces them to run again? And the runoff isn't just an automatic thing that you have to do. The runoff only kicks in when, what is the criteria? Somebody gets elected with under 2% of the vote difference?
No, if somebody doesn't get 50%.
Oh, if somebody doesn't get 50% or more. Okay.
Right.
Because I've heard some cases where the victory has to be greater than, because it's common that there's, you know, if you have enough people, you can't get 50%. So in some cases, I think they make it so that it's that you have to win by more than 2% or by a certain number between the others, so that, you know, they eliminate the need for runoff every time. Because
yeah, I think it's if one person doesn't get more than 50%, then they take the top two people and they have a runoff.
Okay. All right. And see, they do this in every other state. Or not every other state, but they do this in quite a few states.
Different ways.
But in Washington, they don't do it. In California, they don't do runoffs. And so I would love to see, you know, open elections, get rid of the primaries. As a matter of fact, I'm okay if the Republicans want to have a primary, but they have to pay for it. I'm okay if the Democrats want to have a primary. They have to pay for it. The party should be paying for all of the cost of having that election done, and that they manage it themselves, that they're closed. I think primaries should be closed. They shouldn't be open. And so that, you know, you go pay for that, and you've got to be a party member to vote in it. Because right now, you know how many party members there are that are capable of voting? It's like a very small percentage of each state. Anyway, we're getting into these problems and so forth, and we're at that point. When you do the examination of parties and so forth, and this freedom of being able to get your name and being able, like Hamilton says, anybody can get into office. No, not anymore. The reality is the parties have seized control, and the legislatures have empowered that paradigm in creating laws and inducing these things. Oh, you got to have so many signatures. Oh, you need so much money to get your name on the ballot, so forth and so on. It's all protecting access to those seats. They're controlling access where the Constitution doesn't allow this. Anyway, I'm G.R. Mobley. We're Reclaiming the Republic, and we need your help. God bless.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review, as well as my description of the republic review model, on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how republic review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you.